Hello and welcome to the World Soccer Talk podcast, your weekly dose of talking about watching soccer on TV, online, and apps. Coming up on episode 65, we discuss several different topics, including an interview with Andres Canto from Telemundo about the World Cup, as well as our thoughts about the Champions League from this past week and tons of news, and also, of course, MLS TV ratings. So my name is Christopher Harris, a.k.a. The Gaffer, and I'm joined today by Kartik Krishnaiyer. Kartik, how are you doing today?
I'm doing well. How about you?
Good, really good. It's that time of the year still where there's, so many great soccer games on. And also, I think in some ways we're being stretched thin. I mean, we're having like some of these late night 11 p.m. Eastern kickoffs in CONCACAF Champions League. And then with the time change, everything's all screwed up. But I'm still enjoying it. Hopefully you are too.
So, yeah, the time change got me this week in terms of UEFA Champions League. I didn't see any of it because it's an hour later. I'm in an office, so I'm wrapping up my day, then getting on the road and driving home. So I missed it.
Yeah, it's definitely an adjustment. I mean, because for me, I have kids, so sometimes picking up kids from school and it kind of interferes with that. I watched all the games, but it's an adjustment. 1 hour makes a big change. We'll save that for another podcast in terms of talking about the daylight saving time. All right, so we've got a lot going on in this episode. So let's start off, Kartik, by talking about what we've been watching this past week, and I'll have you kick it off, and we'll go through day by day.
Yeah, so I didn't see anything on Thursday or Friday. Saturday morning was the early Liverpool-Manchester kickoff and was real excited for that match. Got up an hour early to watch a pregame on NBC, and Rebecca Lowe was back hosting, and Kyle Martino now seems very comfortable once again. Well, he never was not comfortable, but it feels like he never left, right? Mm-hmm. So things are back to normal. There's some normalcy about the NBC crew. Three-man booth at Anfield, or excuse me, at Old Trafford. Arlo White back on the mic. Lee Dixon, Graham Lasso, all the build-up, all the hype. Is Mourinho going to park the bus? Will he open up? How will Klopp force this match open? And unfortunately, I mean, I thought it was a good match. It was entertaining, but it was unfortunately sort of predictable that United would go very direct, get a goal or two. Brilliant decision by Mourinho to start Marcus Rashford, something he doesn't do very often, or hadn't done actually in 2 months at the time. And that forced Liverpool to chase the game, and they almost equalized at the end, right? They had several corners, a succession of great chances and half chances. But that was interesting because I think it was once again NBC's full team of activated, back in the saddle. Now the early start time owed itself more to China, right, and the Far East, and right. and that market where Premier League rights continue to explode. If you look at the latest package in China, how much the Premier League is netting from that compared to the previous deal.
I would say though, Kartik, too, I mean, for me, I, in terms of the analysis in this one, and sometimes the three-man booth, I'm not a big fan of. It's sometimes people talking over each other and just incessantly people talking. But one instance in this game, which was really a good crystallization of how it does work well sometimes, is when you had Lee Dixon and Graham Lasso and Arlo White, all of them talking about Lovren and Van Dijk's positioning to try to stop the aerial threat of Lukaku. And they saw it early on in terms of what United's tactics were. I thought it was a little bit unpredictable. I wasn't expecting this, but that's just me. But when it did happen, they were really studying Lovren and saying, okay, in terms of what he should be doing, whether he should be going up for those aerial duels or whether he should be just trying to, nudge his arm or elbow into the back of Lukaku to throw him off, just know that he's there. And that I thought was good. And then that's something too that the analysis, that's the type of stuff I want to hear. I want to hear a kind of in-game analysis where it makes me look at the game that's happening before my eyes and go, okay, let's watch that. Let's see how the positioning is. And that's something, too, that oftentimes we don't get with other commentators.
Yeah, so this was a rare match this in the last season or two for NBC, in that most of the matches where they've had a three-man booth, they've had a full setup around the match, have been either 11 a.m. Eastern time start times on the East Coast of the U.S. or 12:30 p.m. Eastern time start times on the East Coast of the U.S. So what we got used to in the days when Fox used to have the rights in the United States was the big matches being on very early because they were focusing on the Asian market. This is the first game I can remember this season that might have been that way. That might have been that early. Now, we've had some 8:30 a.m., right, kickoffs on Sundays of big matches where NBC's had a three-man booth and their entire weekend presentation has been focused around the one match, or at least a good chunk of their weekend presentation. So yeah. It was kind of harkening back to an older era in that sense. But
in some ways, though, too, Kartik, I think kind of the Champions League makes that decision easier. You mean United with a game on Tuesday? I'm sure United was looking, okay, let's get the earliest possible fixture in on that weekend. It just so happens that it's against Liverpool, which is a major game. Still, we'll get into TV ratings a little bit later, but yeah, for Asia, it's a slam dunk. I mean, two of the biggest teams in Great Britain playing against each other.
Yeah, so I felt like probably obviously inhibited the rating, as did quite honestly. A lot of United fans may be looking ahead to Champions League, feeling like they're out of the Premier League race, and Liverpool fans, the elation of going to Champions League quarterfinals. And this will be, I don't remember the last time. I guess it would be 2007 would be the last time Liverpool got further than Manchester United in the Champions League. So this is, I'm just thinking offhand, the 06-07 season might have been the last time and that was when United lost to AC Milan in the semifinals. Liverpool then lost to them in the final in Athens. Boy, so this is actually, even though they've gotten one point against them in the league and lost this league fixture, this is a time in many ways, because we know Liverpool supporters and actually a lot of Manchester United supporters look at Europe first, that this is a good time for Liverpool. But moving on, the 3 p.m., kickoffs in British Standard Time, 10 a.m. Eastern Time, kind of checked them all out. Nothing that interesting. I'm sure you want to comment on the Swansea game. You get sent off after 9 minutes. Somehow they got a draw. I mean, Swansea is just on this remarkable run, right?
Yeah. I mean, this one, Kartik, I mean, for me, so I had one of my kids was playing soccer, had a soccer game at that time. So I had to go on basically switch off all phones, switch off all communications, and then come back several hours later to watch this game and watch it live. Well, it felt live. It wasn't. And then not knowing what the score was. But, I mean, yes, for those who missed it, Jordan Ayew getting sent off in the ninth minute. So Swansea had to play for 80 minutes with 10 men. Not only did they play with 80 minutes for 10 men, but there was 7 minutes added time from the first half and second half combined. So 87 minutes with 10 men. They had 19% possession. They had zero shots on goal. Huddersfield had 30 shots on goal. Actually, 30 shots total. Some of them weren't on goal, but 30 shots. And in this game, it felt like a huge win. This was an incredible result. I mean, for Swansea, obviously, I mean, every point at this stage matters. I mean, getting a draw, getting 1 point is a huge lift, especially with the relegation battle so congested, with the teams just separated by points and goal difference. But for me, Kartik, for Huddersfield, this is not a good look. I mean, yes, Swansea's a good team in terms of the way they're set up and they're hard to break down. But to play for 90 minutes, almost 90 minutes, with an extra man, with the vast majority of the possession, to have 30 shots made and still not get a goal, it's a bad look for Huddersfield, and it's really a warning sign for them. But so I missed this, though, Kartik. So when I was at my daughter's soccer game, and I came back and then saw the Huddersfield Swansea game, and then I heard about the West Ham Burnley game, and I missed it. So I watched the highlights, watched the game highlights of this one, I think on NBCSports.com, I think it was. And there was nothing about the pitch invasion, nothing about the stadium at all. I thought, oh, that's kind of strange. But there was, a follow-up video that came right after it that went into more detail about the pitch invasion. So I missed it. Did you get a chance to watch any of the footage of the pitch invasion and everything that happened? And what are your thoughts on that?
Yeah, I mean, I had expressed to the chagrin of many of our listeners on our predecessor podcast, World Soccer Talk, my concerns about West Ham moving into that stadium, my feeling going back to 2011, it's been a pretty consistent position I've had, my feeling that you have a couple of elements that are problematic, which is one, trying to have security for a stadium that size. Two, West Ham's fan base not being as large as Tottenham's, who was the other club, big club that was thinking about moving to that stadium. Now, it would have been kind of a relocation in terms of geography completely for a North London club. But even for West Ham, it's still about 3.5-4 miles, I believe, from the Bowling Ground. The fact that it's a longer walk from the train station to that ground, the fact that it's not really kind of built for a football ground, which would create a more of a distant relationship between supporters and the game, and would affect viewing on television and in person. And then obviously, in order to justify the giveaway of that stadium to West Ham, what is virtually a giveaway of that stadium to West Ham, and they're controlling that facility, the ticket prices have been dropped, which this is a difficult subject. You don't really want to get into it, and we're not going to get into it on this show, but I will just tease it saying that there has been a feeling among many around English football that the higher ticket prices that we feel like, and I often feel like disenfranchise a lot of supporters, is useful in some places because it keeps a certain element out of the grounds. Now, we have seen trouble at West Ham since they moved into that stadium. Okay, this wasn't a one-off. This wasn't the first time something had happened. I think back to the League Cup tie against Chelsea, I guess maybe a month after they moved into the stadium in 2016, September of 2016, October of 2016, the talk of violence on the route from the underground station to the ground, and then some of the crowd trouble between Chelsea and West Ham supporters, who of course have a history and have a history of this sort of thing during that match day. So, it's unfortunate. I think that it's a big problem. There's also a situation where West Ham United is not playing entertaining football. They're a club whose supporters, now this is cliche-ish, Chris, but if you talk to West Ham supporters, they are almost as concerned about, if not more concerned about, the style of football and the entertainment level versus the results. I can remember the year they were down in the championship. Some of them were saying, well, Sam Allardyce was their manager. He got them back up. But some West Ham fans I speak to said, you know what, we'd rather just stay in the championship and play our football rather than this dire stuff and have to watch this dire stuff. They're a club with that specific ethos. They're a great British club, right? That's what they are. Great English club, I should say, with Bobby Moore, Jeff Hurst, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. Trevor Brooking was at the game, so he saw all this happen.
I think it's a mixed bag. I mean, you do have some West Ham supporters who want to see the club go down, and hopefully then things can fix themselves and they come back up, a better club, a better team. But then you've got other West Ham supporters that have said, okay, well, they've been down before, with the same owners, and they've come back up, and it's the same, if not worse. But to me, all these issues stem from the club not playing well on the pitch. I mean, losing last week two weeks ago to Swansea 4-1, then losing at home to Burnley, and Burnley's a great team this season, and very, very well organized. And Ashley Barnes is Chris Woods. You got some really good players, but in West Ham supporters' minds, losing to Burnley at home 3-0, they're looking down on Burnley. They're thinking, okay, Burnley's just this second-rate team, while West Ham has all of this tradition and history.
You think maybe, speaking of the match, Everton could still use Aaron Lennon? It's been a different player since he went to Burnley. And that might be about Sean Dyche as a manager.
Well, So I missed the game itself, but then I watched the highlights. And the highlights, I mean, the first half, it was all West Ham. Second half, it was all Burnley. But what I did, I went ahead and went to YouTube and watched a video from a YouTube account called Hammers Chat. And I highly recommend it, even if you're not a West Ham supporter, if you want to find out what's going on at this club to better understand what happened that day. And it's a guy, you mean, before the game, pre-match, talking to the West Ham supporters, getting kind of their feelings about the team selection and this, that, and the other, and then going into the stadium and then just seeing what happens and filming it and giving the feedback from the West Ham supporters. To me, it was enlightening to get a really good feel for what's happening inside this club. And it all stems, for this particular game, it stems back from in the second half. And they said that Sean Dyche, basically did a masterclass against Moyes, and that Moyes wasn't playing with a striker. Sean Dyche made the change, brought on Chris Wood, and it changed the game completely. And Moyes took quite a long time to bring on, I think, Chicharito as a sub. And by that point, the game was already lost. And that's where it stems from, is that toxic atmosphere is from fans being dissatisfied with the way the club is playing on the pitch. But then once that happens, they start looking at everything else. They start looking at the board, the bad decisions that they've made in terms of transfer signings. And then they look at the move to the Olympic Stadium, and that just makes things, I mean, even worse than what they are. If they were winning matches, I think it wouldn't be an issue, wouldn't be as much of an issue. And then Kartik, Moyes takes the team to Miami, and there's pictures of them on the beach at the Fountain Blue Hotel on Miami Beach, a beautiful hotel. And that's where they are now. So they're probably about an hour south of us on the beach having sun for some warm weather training because they're not playing for a couple of weeks. It's crazy. I mean, I guess in Moyes' defense, this trip had been planned for a while. But the timing of this is really awful for West Ham United and the supporters.
And Golden Sullivan and Karen Brady as the chief executive, obviously this same team of owners and executives were not well-liked at Birmingham City and got run out of that club, but to a certain extent by supporters. They've never really been trusted at West Ham. I think there's been a feeling, going back to Karen Brady's infamous comments, that they would rebrand the club West Ham Olympic to get the stadium, right? And to honor the athletics tradition of that ground. This was back in 2011. There's been a feeling those owners and that leadership team is distant from the supporters. I think either Gold or Sullivan, maybe it was Sullivan, says he grew up a West Ham supporter. He's from the East End, but that hasn't mollified the views of supporters toward them. They now own the club for 8 years. Things have not gotten better, and I just don't see this ending well, honestly. And unfortunately, they can't go back to the bowling ground that's being redeveloped as we speak. I don't know. This is what I feared for years, that this was going to be a bad move for West Ham, and that they were a club with an ethos, Chris. And this is important for listeners to understand. Everybody wants their club to be massive. They want their club to be big. They want their club to sell shirts in Asia and in the United States and get all this TV money. West Ham is a classic English club that embody the East End of London and the working class ethos and even some of the ethnic diversity now that's come into the East End of London. They do not need to be Tottenham, Arsenal, or Chelsea, okay? But Golden Sullivan felt like we needed to compete with those clubs on a global scale, kind of rebrand the club, make it into this big thing to get commercial dollars. That's not right for every club. And that's a lesson, I think, to clubs all over the world, including here in the United States, everywhere, that sometimes when you have an identity and you have a history, you respect that and you stick to that rather than wanting to chase money from all over the place and risk losing that identity.
Yeah, just as the Columbus Crew is a fascinating story, I think West Ham United is too, in a different way. But I mean, the risk is obviously that there's a good chance they could get relegated if they keep on playing the way they're playing. Hopefully they'll bounce back when they get back from this break. But It's fascinating to watch, and I got a feel for West Ham United supporters going through all of this. And Moyes is definitely in a tough position where he's got to keep this team up, and then behind the scenes they have to try to repair the damages to this club in terms of the way it's been run. And it's I mean, that's the thing too. I mean, when clubs are winning, Everything's rosy. Swansea's a good example of that. Now that they're winning games, and there's not a lot of talk about the American owners or dissatisfaction with American owners, etc. But when the club is starting to lose games and it gets depressing, it does turn toxic, no matter what club it is. All right, Kartik, let's move on. So what else? Was there anything else you watched on Saturday?
Okay, so we also had a game between Bayer and Mönchengladbach, Bayer Leverkusen, who continue to really impress. And this is an interesting year, for us, Chris, having visited Leverkusen, having visited Schalke a few seasons ago, having visited Dortmund. Those three clubs all, at this point, would qualify for the Champions League. Leverkusen playing very well. This was a pretty decisive, good match they played against Mönchengladbach. To win 2-0. I also saw snippets of Hoffenheim beating Wolfsburg, who are just, I don't even know how to describe how poor that club has been the last year and a half, in spite of management changes, in spite of signing some interesting players. So Leverkusen continues to roll on in the Bundesliga, and it's looking like for Leipzig, their best shot of getting back in the Champions League might be to win the Europa League. So watch that space as we get down to the end of the Europa League campaign. Also, Chelsea Palace, Derek Ray and Danny Higginbotham. Derek Ray was not calling a Bundesliga game on Saturday. He was calling a game for NBC Sports with Danny Higginbotham at the Bridge. Chelsea won, and N'Golo Kanté returned. I thought Ray and Higginbotham were brilliant as usual. But there was something very unnerving about Chelsea's performance in that match. Wilfred Zaha comes back for Palace. Chris, as we look at the relegation fight in the Premier League, I think Crystal Palace is going to get out of this with Zaha back and with their other injuries back. I think Swansea, I know Swansea is still, you're probably very nervous still given the point total, but the way they're playing, they should be fine. I think now we can hone in on five teams for relegation. Huddersfield, who really needed the 3 points given the advantage they were given against Swansea. Huddersfield, West Brom, West Ham, Stoke, and Southampton. Three will come from those five, I think. And West Brom pretty much down. Also watch the Tigres-Tijuana game, Club Tijuana-Zolos match later that night on Univision Deportes. I wanted to get a look at MLS's CONCACAF Champions League competition for the upcoming week and also really enjoy the way Tigres plays. Kept an eye on Orlando and Minnesota on MLS Live or on MLSsoccer.com. A very, very good game for Ethan Finley, a player who maybe should be looked at in the U.S. player pool. Unfortunately, Kevin Molino stretchered off, a former Orlando City great at both the USL and MLS level, now with Minnesota with his old manager, Adrian Heath. We've learned now it's an ACL tear, and he will be out for a long time. And that probably, even though it's week two, that's probably curtains on Minnesota's season. So that was the rest of the Saturday for me.
Yeah, and actually, just to rewind slightly, Kartik, I did watch a couple of games on the Thursday and Friday. The Thursday was the Europa League, Milan against Arsenal. And on that one, Keith Costigan continues to improve as a commentator. He's getting better as he does more and more games. I think Friday was the Mainz against Schalke game, and that was a pretty poor game except for one beautiful goal by Caligiuri for Schalke. And
I forgot to mention I did watch the Milan Arsenal game, and it's amazing what Arsenal can do when they're away from London.
Well, the funny thing is like for like maybe like what they had about 45 minutes pre-game. And for about 40 minutes of those 45 minutes, it was like Hate Week from 1984 by George Orwell, if you've seen the movie or read the book. But it was all, for 40 minutes, just all against Wenger. Like, why isn't Wenger more vocal? Why isn't he getting up? And it was all anti-Wenger for about 40 minutes. And I had a feeling that Arsenal would bounce back, that they would get the result. And of course, then the subject changes and... that consistency is the thing that we're missing with Arsenal. But I just thought it was a little bit funny that both, I think, Stuart Holden and Warren Barton went just all at Wenger on that one.
Now, yeah, that's it. I think Fox now has learned that sells, much the way ESPN FC has the whole year. I mean, look, the ESPNFC program for the last 2 weeks has either been Mourinho night or Wenger night. I mean, there's been no – that's really every day that they pick a topic. I haven't watched yesterday's show yet, post-Conte Barcelona, but they Mourinho still gets picked on when he wins, like he did against Liverpool, because of the feeling as well, he was too playing too directly in the first half. Okay, they got the two goals, but then the second half they sat back, right? So I think both these managers, and we see how the media affects Mourinho, right? We saw him lash out at Frank de Boer this week. Mm-hmm. This is going to continue, I think, even in the U.S. press towards both Mourinho and Wenger. And obviously, the Mourinho discussion then was had. We haven't gotten there yet, I'm sorry, but that was then had on Fox on Tuesday.
Yep, exactly. So on Sunday, I watched the Atlanta DC United game. I watched the first half of this game. And this is like the second week in a row now with Major League Soccer that I've watched just a half of a game just because one of the teams was so good and the other team was so poor. And in this one, it was all Atlanta United, really unimpressed by DC United in this match. But the attendance, MLS record, was fantastic to see. A full house there at Mercedes-Benz Stadium and a great atmosphere and a great win for Atlanta United.
Yeah, to be honest with you, I completely forgot this game was going on, and I was watching the college basketball game that was on immediately preceding the Atlanta DC game, which then spilled over into the time slot, which college basketball always does. We talk about that almost every week. And it was like, oh, okay, this game is on. So I kept the television on. I had forgotten that game was on because I was preparing to watch Inter and Napoli on VN, which I did watch at the same time, which was a match I enjoyed. I know people see 0-0 and they see Serie A and they think, oh my gosh, I couldn't watch that. But it was a very good tactical battle. Spalletti had his team trying to play more directly to counter the press, the high pressing of Napoli. Napoli, though, they needed 3 points, right? And now we're beginning to get nervous that this title race in Italy is beginning to take on the same form that previous title races where Juve have faced competition but have pulled away in February or March, that the same thing is happening this season, coupled with the result the previous week at home against Roma, where they gave up lost 4-2, that this could be ending. But this was a good broadcast. I enjoyed the game. I did not really enjoy the Atlanta DC game, which I had on at the same time, so I can't give you anything tangible from that match. As I said, I wouldn't have even had that match on if it hadn't been for the SEC championship game before. And once the game's on turf, the game start, DC was really poor, as you said, my attention shifted to the Serie A match.
So what about any other games on Sunday, Kartik?
No, that was it.
Okay, so let's move on to Monday.
I guess the Premier League games in the morning, the Spurs Brighton game.
Bournemouth,
excuse me. Yeah, that match, which we saw Harry Kane get injured, and it was an odd day because here's the thing: Arsenal, when they win, it seems like there's nothing to talk about, and they won 3-0, even though they didn't play particularly well, right? You almost have to suspend that Arsenal conversation, and we're now so used to having that conversation. They played well in Milan at the San Siro on Thursday, and then that game. But yeah, I watched those two matches as well.
Okay, so moving on to Monday, we had the Stoke City against Manchester City game. Martin Tyler so eloquently put it during this broadcast in the commentating. He says the English dictionary is running out of superlatives to describe Manchester City this season. And yet again, Kartik, a really entertaining performance by City. Stoke definitely were fighting, but just completely outclassed by a team that's just on song. I mean, it's a team that makes things look so easy in terms of the build-up play, the teamwork. It's the teamwork, especially these goals. I mean, the number of players that they're passing to and the runs off the ball, just precision and a joy to watch.
Yeah, and the Manchester City supporters, a lot of the other ones beside myself get angry when I say this, although there are some that agree with me that Sergio Aguero scores a lot of goals, and that's his utility. He scores goals, but the team plays better. And I actually did, there was some of this element even in the pre-Pep days. The team plays better when he's not in the team. Jesus's movement as a number nine in Pep's system is more fluid and more interchangeable with Sané and Sterling. And so you tend to get you tend to get better movement and more free flowing football, believe it or not, without Aguero in there. Now, of course, no one on the club has a Aguero's finishing ability and ability to score goals. So this was 2-0. It might have been 4-0 with Aguero, right? But the football, I think, is better when he doesn't play. And that's a long-term observation of mine, and saw it again in this game. One quick broadcast note on this game. Lee McHugh was the NBC host, did a very good job. I noticed at the outtake, they were throwing it to NASCAR. He didn't wear glasses the whole broadcast. He put his glasses on to read from the teleprompter. Did you notice that as well?
Yeah, I noticed that too. Yeah,
that was a little odd because so at least we know he wasn't reading from the teleprompter prior to that.
Which is good though too, because he's probably more comfortable just kind of stringing it along, which it seems more natural rather than having to read word for word off the teleprompter.
Which he's very good with, he did a very good job again as host, the typical Monday host for NBC's Monday games. But then that was just kind of odd because the outtake to the NASCAR, he has these big whatever term you would use,
like reading glasses.
Yeah, reading glasses. It's like, whoa, he wasn't wearing that before the break. But anyway,
so on Tuesday it was, of course, the big one, Kartik, Roma against Shakhtar. No, I'm just joking. That one was on Facebook Live. Roma advancing and looking good. And then you had the Man United against Sevilla game. And before we go into talking about the tactics and these English teams in the Premier League, I just got to say that with Man United out, it's a big blow for Fox Sports in their final season of US rights to the UEFA Champions League. Man United always gets big numbers on the English language side. And I'm sure that FS1 was kind of dreaming, or Fox was dreaming of having a United Barca or United Real Madrid final, or maybe a Real Madrid now and Barca final. Wherever it may be, though, Kartik, Fox has had some really bad luck over the years with the Champions League. And a lot of it comes back to the English teams getting knocked out. And a lot of it is, it's the same complaint that I think we have year after year, which is defensively, they're poor. What do you think?
Yeah, and I think there's also an issue in terms of the ability of Manchester United to control the midfield of these games, right? So he starts with Fellaini and Matic, and they're getting run over in midfield, partly because I think he's seeing Fellaini as a guy who can go forward and get target balls lobbed to him. It would be the same thing if he played Pogba. Now there would be a different dynamism, it's not, I don't think it's a coincidence, though, that Sevilla's two goals and really the third shot that Ben Yedder should have, the third chance he had that he should have buried, came after Pogba entered the match. There's some limited dynamism in that midfield with an injured Ander Herrera. And if you talk to United fans who are more attuned tactically and not just watching these games and transfers and saying, oh, well, Pogba's a 100 million pound player or what have you, they seem to favor a midfield that includes Herrera because he's a fighter. He's a guy who can shadow the other team's best player. In this case, it would have been Venega, and really take that fight, that kind of a fight that United needs in the midfield with Carrick at the end of his career. Without Herrera, they, in retrospect, not having Herrera was a big deal, and they just didn't look it. I mean, they didn't look it at all in the 180 minutes. It wasn't just in the second leg. So,
right,
a lot for Mourinho to ponder now, or because the question now is, what happens to Jose Mourinho? They're not going to sack him, but United supporters, who again, this entertainment thing, as we talked about with West Ham. You better be getting results if you're not entertaining at Manchester United. And he's not getting optimum results, although the results have improved since Louis van Gaal. They've also spent a lot more money since van Gaal left under Mourinho. And they're not entertaining. So that's the question. And for Fox, this is very important. They're now in a position where I think they're going to want Liverpool to go the distance and get to a final against either Barcelona or Real Madrid. We'll see the draw on Friday, tomorrow. Yeah. We're taping this Thursday morning. But I think for Fox's purposes, in their final year leading into the World Cup, they're going to want a strong run now from Liverpool since Manchester United's out.
Yeah, and Manchester City doesn't have a lot of spectators or supporters in the United States yet. And that's the thing, too. I got some heat on my comments on Twitter saying about it's a big blow for Fox with Man United out. And heat from some people in the industry saying, like, what do you mean? Like, that makes no difference. Well, it does make a difference because without, say, a Premier League side in the Champions League final or in the latter stages of the Premier League, of the Champions League, is that you lose that audience. A lot of people will tune out and won't watch a Juventus against Real Madrid final because they don't watch La Liga, they don't watch Serie A. They should watch both of those, but they don't. So Liverpool's with a huge supporters base and with a Premier League audience would bring a bigger audience to a final than a Juventus against Barca.
Throw this out there: NBC's Premier League ratings stagnated last season, not this season. This season we've seen a bump. They stagnated last season. My theory, and I think we've talked about this before on this show. Yep. Obviously, sports ratings were down. Maybe the Premier League has hit a saturation point in the United States, but also Man United finishing sixth in the league, Man United not being in the title race, Mourinho playing the type of football he was playing. That all has an impact because Manchester United in most markets, the United States market, Latin America, Asia, although Asia, Chelsea is kind of almost a parity with them, Africa, although Arsenal is almost a parity with them there, and Chelsea's got some support. But in most global markets outside the UK, they are the driver of the Premier League, for better or for worse. And anytime I say this to Manchester City supporters, they get angry. There's just not that many Manchester City supporters in the United States. There's just not that many around the globe. It's improving. They're not just not as many Chelsea supporters, although Chelsea's now out of the Champions League too, so it's a moot conversation in terms of this tournament. But the reality is Manchester United is a huge driver, even for NBC. They're not going to win the title this year, but they're being back in second and beating Liverpool and getting some of the results they've gotten, I think has helped NBC's ratings, quite frankly.
Absolutely. Yeah, it's a huge factor. I mean, with United, when they do have a poor season or poorer season than they usually do, the ratings drop dramatically. So it's Kartik now on Tuesday night. I didn't see any of the CONCACAF Champions League games this week, but what are your thoughts about Tuesday night's broadcast?
Yeah, so the Red Bulls look very good, very comfortable down in Tijuana. Now, I have to say, when you play at Tijuana, it is Mexico, but there's American fans there. It's a little different, right? It's not like going to Azteca and playing Club America. It's not the same thing, right? It's not like going to Jalisco and playing Chivas. So New York, comfortable victory. Yes, it's an MLS victory in Mexico. Credit to New York Red Bulls. I think Jesse Marsh, for me, if the U.S. is going to appoint an American coach, I've been saying this consistently since before the U.S. was eliminated from qualifying. That's the guy that's at the top of my list. He integrates youth players. He's used his reserve team well to deepen his squad, to be competitive at the CONCACAF level. They play football. They at least try and play football the right way. Their possession, our friend Chris, Coach Chris Glock, who has the possession with a purpose index. New York Red Bull is always at the top of that for MLS, and he's pragmatic enough to be defensive when he needs to, but likes good passing football. So New York wins, and then obviously Tigres TFC, the titanic battle between arguably the two best teams in this confederation. TFC wins on away goals. Tigres wins the second leg. Great match, some controversial officiating, just a great spectacle for CONCACAF. It's unfortunate for CONCACAF. They only have a few of these clubs that can play at that high level. And then also kind of a touching story after the match where André Pierre Gignac, the French superstar for Tigres, went to the TFC bus to give his shirt to one of the TFC players. So a lot of mutual respect there as well.
All right, Kartik, let's move on to Wednesday and Champions League matches. There was the Besiktas against Bayern Munich early game at 1 o'clock Eastern time. I watched most of this match, and I always enjoy watching Besiktas play because their fans are so passionate about the club. And even losing 8-1 on aggregate, the fans were still on their feet. singing loudly and proudly, as loud as ever, and also gave Bayern a standing ovation at the end of the game. So I've always been a big fan of Beşiktaş. Well, actually, since 2006, when I first saw them play on Setanta Sports against Spurs in the UEFA Cup at their own stadium, their old stadium. And they just had an incredible noise and passion at that time. And I was just won over, and I've always kind of had a soft spot for Beşiktaş. But Bayern advances, no surprise there.
I wanted to watch this match because it was the Beşiktaş home leg, and Beşiktaş being having the atmosphere you described. My office doesn't have FS2.
Yeah. That's a shame.
That's what happens. Unfortunately, with FS2, and it's not that Fox isn't unaware of it. It's just they're at a point where I don't think it's getting fixed in a lot of places.
Which for the World Cup, I mean, that's the good news, is that none of the games are on FS2, so it's a reality I think the Fox has to deal with, that the numbers don't seem to be increasing at all, and if anything, they're decreasing in terms of number of subscribers, and it's just they can't seem to get around that issue. And then watched Barcelona against Chelsea. To me, I was not entertained in this match. Barcelona were incredible, but it wasn't a two-sided match to me. And I just wonder where this Chelsea team has gone, the one that was last season in the league that was so good. And at the time, I was thinking, okay, wouldn't this be wonderful if they were in the Champions League because they were so strong versus the team that we have now, which is a pale shadow of themselves. I mean, so many mistakes, so many chances just blown. And a really poor performance from Chelsea in this one, and Barcelona advances. So, Kartik, on Wednesday, did you get a chance to watch any of the CONCACAF Champions League matches?
Yeah, I should point out that I didn't see the Chelsea-Barca game either. I didn't see the Sevilla-Man United game live as well, but I did watch that on DVR and watched the match in its entirety and the post-game. The Chelsea-Barca match, I have to be honest with you, I haven't even bothered. I'll probably delete it from my DVR. There doesn't seem to be a point. I watched Chivas in Seattle late on Wednesday night in the CONCACAF Champions League, and Seattle played okay in the first half. After that, it seemed like their fitness levels, maybe, again, this has to do with the MLS calendar being misaligned for international competitions, being misaligned for anything, quite frankly. Their fitness levels weren't good in the second half. They didn't even really show after halftime, and Chivas pulled them apart and overcame that first leg deficit and won 3-1. And move on. So the CONCACAF Champions League, just real quickly, Chris, we could have a Super Clásico final, America and Chivas, or we could have an all-MLS final, Red Bulls and Toronto. And also Red Bulls and Toronto had some, although Sasha Kleiston's moved on to Orlando, had some trouble last season, if you remember, at the end of the season in the postseason. But unfortunately for CONCACAF, we'll probably get some split decision, right? One MLS team, one Liga MX team. And yeah, you'll have the MLS chorus of MLS fans on social media supporting whatever MLS team is in the final. But it could be really big for CONCACAF if they could get a Super Clásico final, or if they could get an all MLS final. But the difference will probably be split.
Yeah, the timing of this, Kartik, is unfortunate for Fox, because, I mean, Fox had the rights to the CONCACAF Champions League last season and for a few seasons, but no one was watching it because the MLS teams kept on getting blown out, and they were really kind of boring matches to watch, that very one-sided, with very few people in attendance in the stadium, so a really poor television product. And now, finally, the CONCACAF Champions League is interesting again. And the games aren't on English language television. They're on Go90 for English, and they're on Univision Deportes for Spanish language. So the timing's way off there. But maybe this can encourage maybe a TV partner down the road to maybe next year to maybe show some of these games on the English language side.
Yeah, and I'll admit that I've been watching these games on Univision Deportes. I don't know. Don't take this the wrong way, listeners, but I don't even want to get into the frustration of Go90 in the middle of matches, you know, matches of this significance. So maybe it's okay. I don't know.
Yeah, I mean, for me, from personal experience, so with Go90, so some of these games I have watched, maybe a few minutes here, a few minutes there, and most of the times I'll go to Go90 first to go ahead and see it. And when I'm on my mobile phone, it's pretty easy to find the game. And the stream is really good quality. Commentating, it's okay. But when I've gone to the website, so like last night, I think I went to go90.com looking for the game. I think it was the Seattle game, and I couldn't find it. I might go, okay, I know you guys are broadcasting it live. I know it's on right now, and I'm on the Go90 website, and I can't find it. So for whatever reason, the mobile app is definitely easier to find what you're looking for. Website needs a lot of work, but the quality has been good from what I've seen. I just haven't had the time to actually sit down and watch the games. So I got other things going on. All right, speaking of other things going on, Kartik, let's move on to TV streaming news.
Yeah, so Steve Nash has been officially unveiled. We've actually heard the rumors for many weeks, right? As one of the panels for Turner Sports Champions League coverage, in an interview with Grant Wall, Nash says the job is a dream come true for him, and that the Champions League studio will be headquartered, surprisingly, in Los Angeles, not in Atlanta, which gives Turner better access to the soccer talent and established soccer voices. So good decision there, although you wonder logistically, infrastructure-wise, how Turner does that, given everything else they do is in Atlanta, including their train wreck of a NCAA selection show the other day. So they'll have to have producers, they'll have to have TV execs, they'll have to have the appropriate backroom talent as well in Los Angeles.
Yeah, the one thing about Steve Nash in this interview with Grant Wall, which is on the podcast that Grant does, it was eye-opening to me. I knew that Steve Nash had soccer experience, coming from a soccer family, playing the game, supporting the team. But this interview, probably about 45 to 50% of it goes into talking about his passion for the game and his knowledge of the game, his understanding of the game, his ties to the game. And this really is a guy that grew up in a soccer family that eats, lives, and breathes soccer, and admits that he's more excited about soccer, more passionate about soccer than he is about basketball. And this coming from a basketball legend.
Yeah, so, former NBA MVP, by the way, for people who don't know that. I mean, this is a great player.
Right. So if you do get a chance, if you're questioning whether Steve Nash is going to be a good soccer fit, definitely go ahead and listen to the Grant Wall interview, because you will be convinced that he knows his stuff. Now, whether he's any good talent-wise in front of the camera, I mean, we'll have to wait and see. I'm sure he'll be fine, but still, it's a big move for Turner Sports, and that will kick off in August of 2018. It'll be here before you know it. Now, moving on, Kartik, Twitter made a big announcement this week. They've signed a 3-year deal to stream at least 24 Major League Soccer matches per season on Twitter. The broadcasts are from Univision and will feature English language commentary, and the deal is for the US only. So what it means is that the Saturday games that Univision, mostly Saturday, they have some Friday games too, but mostly Saturday games that Univision has, Saturday afternoon, sometimes 3:30, 4 o'clock Eastern time, that they currently have in Spanish language on television, those will continue, but those games will be available also on Twitter, the same feed, except it's going to be an English language commentary over that. So good news for Major League Soccer in terms of accessibility and reach, getting those games into, you know, hopefully into more people's hands, more fans watching these games. And for Twitter, it's a good deal in terms of expanding their platform, trying to encourage more people to be watching live sports on social media.
Yes. Speaking of which, this might be a case of me turning lemons into lemonade. We'll see. The Chicago Fire has abandoned local TV and will stream all their games for the next, actually for 3 seasons, I believe, on ESPN Plus, the new streaming service coming from Disney that we've talked extensively about on this program and on the WorldSoccerTalk.com site. Chris, what people may not realize is that Chicago was not able to find a local television partner. And it was getting down to the 11th hour, or past the 11th hour. It was basically 11:50 with the season kicking off. They made this decision, and I think it might end up being a trendsetter in sports. I mean, I've, in fact, for another publication, I've talked about that it might prove to be that, even though it was done out of necessity. It was done because their backs were against the wall and they didn't have a regional sports affiliate in the Chicagoland area or an over-the-air channel willing to pick up their games.
Yeah, I think the challenge on this one, Kartik, is just having the fans jump through a bunch of hoops. So those fans in the Chicago area who might be accustomed to watching Chicago on local television now have to go to MLSsoccer.com to watch those games there. And then ESPN Plus won't be available until, I believe it was late April or early May, according to one of our sources. And then they're going to have to go to ESPN Plus and then pay $5 a month to watch the games through there. Now, the good thing is that ESPN Plus is pretty promising in terms of what it's offering. The bad thing, though, Kartik, is that there are people out there that don't have high-speed internet, that don't have the latest smartphones, that do watch television and watch the sports on television. So that cuts them out of this whole equation. I mean, of course, those numbers are declining, but still, it's a change. It's a change that has to happen. And I guess at the end of the day, it's better to have some coverage on ESPN Plus than no coverage at all.
Yeah, I know this isn't, we've talked about this subject a month ago when the deal was signed, or a month and a half ago, but I'm already hearing some feedback from contacts in the LA area. Now, LAFC's first two games have been on national television, so the local deal hasn't kicked in yet. I'm already hearing some feedback that some of those fans plan to just watch the game in Spanish rather than paying for YouTube TV because of the cost and because, in some cases, of the factors you're mentioning in terms of high speed, concern about buffering, concern about dropping. So maybe while we thought the YouTube deal and the and now the ESPN Plus deal might be trendsetters, maybe they're coming a year or two too early. Well, time will tell.
Yeah, I think you're right. I think it's ahead of its time. I mean, the YouTube TV deal, the challenge with that, like you said to Kartik, is the price has gone up. So it's gone up from, I think, $35 to $40 a month. And for somebody who's just a LAFC fan that just wants to watch his or her team play and doesn't, you know, is not concerned about the other coverage, perhaps that's a lot of money to fork out. But yeah, the times there are changing. All right, so moving on, Bein Sports is going to have some big games over this international break that's coming up in the next couple of weeks. They're going to have Russia against Brazil, and also Italy against Argentina. Those friendlies are going to be played in Europe, and those games will be coming to Bein Sports live on Friday, March 23rd. So it'll be here before you know it.
Great. Big news this week. MLS and Liga MX have formed a partnership where they'll start stage an annual Campones Cup between the champions of each league. And the inaugural edition will be featuring Toronto FC against the winner of Liga MX Campeón de Campeones tournament. Now, this we've had the Super Liga in the past, which took place in the summer. This might be a much, much bigger deal, this one-off match, which I think will be well-received, and it's going to take place after the Mexican season is back in full swing by about 2 months. During a part of the MLS season, Chris, where we see television ratings and interest generally decline until they pick back up right at the playoffs. So not always from the television ratings department, but at least in fan interest. So the timing is also, I think, quite interesting and good. Oh, I should mention, sorry, I didn't mention the timing. It'll be September 19th this season, and generally the expectation is to have it in the middle of September every year.
Yeah, it'll be interesting to see how this game is played, Kartik, whether it's going to be more of a Community Shield feel or whether it's going to be more of a cup final feel. And a lot of it depends, too, on the players that these teams will field, but also the timing of it, too. Whether it be in September, mid-September, is Toronto at that point more concerned about MLS Cup and resting players, or are they going whole hog and trying to win this one? So it's a good move, regardless. But we'll have to wait and see how this plays out. The other thing too, Kartik, is that Liga MX has said that probably next year, 2019, they're going to have a all-star team that would play against Major League Soccer, presumably in MLS's all-star game. That would be good, and that's something we've been asking for a long time. Some positive moves there from both Major League Soccer and Liga MX. Now, Kartik, this week, World Soccer Talk launched a World Cup Viewer's Guide. It's available for free as a free download from worldsoccertalk.com. This is something I've been working on for the past 2 to 3 months, interviewing different executives at the TV studios to find out all the details, everything from commentators in terms of the schedule, coverage in HD, replays, video on demand, going into all the detail that you, the listener, probably wants to know about the best way to watch the World Cup this summer. And it's available for free from worldsoccertalk.com. And Kartik, moving on to, let's move over to Spain.
Yeah, Barcelona is requesting that the Copa del Rey knockout stages be changed to one game, instant knockout format, instead of the two-leg ties. Now, that would, of course, help Barcelona in Europe and in other competitions. I don't know how that's going to go over. Honestly, it's been two legs, and maybe it's an equalizer. Maybe it gives a greater chance for upsets, but the opposition team always wants a home leg, particularly if they get an additional game against Barcelona or Real Madrid. So we'll see how one goes.
Yeah, and sounds similar to FA Cup too, in terms of a lot of the bigger clubs wanting it just to be one game rather than a replay. But this would be with Copa del Rey. Oftentimes it's two legs. So, but yeah, it's again, times are changing, and maybe that'll happen in Spain. So lastly, Kartik, on the news segment, according to a new study by a research group called Think Now, Fox Sports has its work cut out for it to raise awareness about its World Cup coverage. Now, in this study that was done in November, where they conducted it nationwide among Facebook users in the US who are planning to watch the World Cup, 52% of non-Hispanics surveyed plan on watching the World Cup on ESPN. Now, the big problem is that ESPN does not have the World Cup. Now, the numbers are very similar also to for the Hispanics. So I believe it's about 45% of Hispanics surveyed plan on watching the World Cup on Univision. So both Telemundo and Fox have a big issue, which is that most fans don't even know that who's going to be broadcasting the World Cup. And if you're a casual mainstream sports fan and you've been watching the ESPN World Cup since 2006, right?
Yeah.
It's been a long time. You mean for over a decade watching it on ESPN, you're thinking probably, oh, of course, ESPN will have it again. To me, at the end of the day, what this means, Kartik, is that Fox really needs to do a major advertising campaign. And there's no use advertising on Fox Sports 1 or FS2 saying, hey, we've got the World Cup. That audience already knows that Fox has got the World Cup. The issue is among mainstream fans, you need to do a major campaign to let people know that Fox has the rights. We're going to be showing the games this summer. And same for Telemundo, which I know Telemundo is planning on having the US's largest campaign ever, advertising campaign for the World Cup. They've already made that commitment. So, a lot of work. And it's interesting that these numbers say what they say.
There's work for Telemundo also, because I think if you polled Spanish language dominant soccer fans, Hispanics, you might find similar results of people expecting to watch the World Cup on Univision. So
for sure.
I think Telemundo has work cut out for them, and I expect Fox to advertise heavily on other cable channels in kind of the sweeps in May, and we'll get to building up the World Cup audience for Fox and awareness that it's on Fox Fox and on FS1 in that period. So look for ads in May. That's my hunch. I don't have any inside word on that, but that's what I think they probably will do during sweeps week.
But the challenge is, though, Kartik, is that fewer and fewer people are watching cable television. So
it's true too. Yeah,
you know what I mean, the people that were surveyed were Facebook users. So that's somebody that might watch YouTube, may have. Who knows what they have, whether they're cord cutters or cord nevers. But that's kind of the old model. It was, okay, go ahead and just do a blanket ad campaign on cable, and that'll reach everyone. But this is something that I think personally is that they need to look at everything from social media, Reddit, Facebook, other places to advertise websites majorly that the Fox has the World Cup. But and the same thing for Telemundo, too. They need to do the same thing, too.
Yeah, particularly with millennials. So I'll give you some political experience here. A couple of years ago, I was in a statewide race here in Florida, mid-October, a Democratic candidate. We ended up losing. Every Democrat lost that year. But I finally got advice from the media consultant, hey, stop dumping money on television. We need to pull millennials out. It's a midterm election. Let's throw all our money on Google ads and Facebook. And I'll show you the analytics on this. And I thought, oh my goodness, this is ridiculous. You know, you advertise on television and radio, particularly in the state of Florida, where the audience, where the voter base is older, right? It's an older state. But it worked to pull out millennials and kind of cut the margins to a certain extent. So even in politics, and I guess the Bernie Sanders campaign and Donald Trump campaigns probably all kind of specialized in that as well. So you're right. I think that's the direction it's going.
Hopefully that's the way it's going. All right, so let's move on to TV ratings, Kartik. Some big numbers this past week. We had 1.2 million people tuned in to watch Club America against Lyon on Univision and Univision Deportes Network on Saturday. Tigres against Tijuana, 931,000 viewers. And then the biggest number from the English language speaking side was surprisingly Bournemouth against Spurs, which had 644,000 viewers on NBCSN and Telemundo. I think that the difference on this one, Kartik, was a lot of it's the timing of it. With the time changes happening in the US, not in the UK, this game kicked off at noon on Sunday to 2 p.m. Eastern. And I think the Telemundo, which I think had about 200,000 viewers on that one, plus the NBCSN, made it more favorable for NBC there.
Yeah, I think this is a case where NBC will probably be unhappy that they lose one of the one Saturday after the time change, where every kickoff would be an hour later due to the international break. So they would have the early game kicking off at 8:30. They'd have a bunch of games kicking off at 11 Eastern time, and then the final game at 1:30 Eastern time, right? They're going to have that this Saturday. They'll lose that next week. That we've seen in the past, that week ratings, there's a bit of a bump when the matches start later, which debunks the theory that a lot of MLS proponents have that because the Premier League is not going up against any sports competition, that the ratings are higher. Look, everybody has other things to do Saturday and Sunday morning than sit and watch football, honestly. And even you, I mean, you've got your kids. I've got other things going on that I make sacrifices to watch the Premier League or watch the Bundesliga on Saturday morning. So to say, well, it's because there's no sporting competition, the only other thing on is cartoons, is nonsense.
Yeah, it's for me too. I mean, for me, I have to make sacrifices to watch Major League Soccer. I guess it all depends on each individual. I mean, so for me, usually my afternoons and evenings are busier. I got more stuff going on. But then again, though, too, I probably have framed my life around Saturday mornings and Sunday mornings, where my family knows that oftentimes that's Chris's time. But then again, though, too, I mean, that doesn't, I mean, there's soccer games on, there's errands, there's parties, there's birthday parties and things like that. Life does get in the way sometimes, but I guess it's that whole appointment time viewing thing. And two big matches this past weekend for a lot of our listeners, Kartik, would have been Man United against Liverpool on that Saturday morning, and then for on the Sunday, Atlanta against DC United. What are your thoughts about the numbers, and also if you can share those numbers with the listeners?
Yeah, so 576,000 for Atlanta DC United on ESPN. Great rating. I tweeted about it, saying, "Hey, look, it beat at least in English language portion beat the English language for every Premier League match this weekend." But I have to mention a couple things. One, I think Atlanta gets a natural bump. We saw that last season. We saw it again this year. Packed house. It engages people. People want to watch, right? Even though there's artificial turf, which bothers some of us. Second, there was a big college basketball game leading in, which was Kentucky and Tennessee, a game I was watching, and I had forgotten about the MLS game, but I was prepared to just watch Serie A after the basketball game was over. and ended up watching a little MLS along with the Serie A I was watching. So that, I think, lead-in helped it. And college sports fans, as we talked about for years, and I've had a nice back and forth with Jack Bell, our former New York Times writer, after this rating was posted, college sports fans are more inclined to probably watch soccer than American pro sports fans, because there's so many similarities in supporters and traveling fans and just the optics and passion around it, culture around it, correct? And then also, this was the SEC championship game, and we're talking about Atlanta United. So that there's also that natural correlation. There's no bigger SEC city than Atlanta. In fact, the SEC title game is usually in Atlanta, would have been at Mercedes-Benz Stadium, I think, typically, if Atlanta United hadn't been playing. They used to play that at the Georgia Dome every year. So there was that natural correlation.
Yeah, two things on that real quick, Kartik, too, is that definitely the timing helped. But I must give credit to ESPN, though, too, because this is the second week in a row where I've been entertained during halftime. I mean, I watched, again, the first week it was the ESPN FC bus where they interviewed Bob Bradley for that interview, but this one it was Brad Guzan in the ESPN bus, and also I forgot to mention too, even from last week from the LAFC Seattle game, having Will Ferrell on. You mean being interviewed, joking around. I mean, ESPN definitely is trying really, really hard to make a difference, to not be predictable. And that's my issue with Fox's coverage, whether it's MLS or Champions League. It's so predictable. It's so scripted. You know almost exactly what's going to happen at what moment. And I'm sick of watching it. But that's the first thing. And then the second thing is that why isn't NYCFC or New York Red Bulls getting these numbers? I mean, Atlanta's definitely an exciting team and, I mean, a great support. But these are big numbers for Atlanta. And why isn't the New York area getting some of these big numbers too for these games that are on ESPN, on a Sunday?
Why doesn't MLS just accept this? I mean, I've been having this battle with people for 6 or 7 years. In those days, it was about Portland and Seattle, and it still would be about Portland and Seattle, because Seattle will get on the whole better national numbers than the LA Galaxy or New York FC or New York Red Bulls. Why can't they just accept that there's some smaller markets, not small markets, smaller markets, still large markets. In the case of Atlanta, it's still a huge market. In the case of Seattle, it's a medium-sized market that their teams drive a national audience and national interest greater than the teams in New York and LA. This is part of MLS's mindset. They don't quite get it. And part of the thing of being in New York and having all their executives in New York is I don't think they quite get the culture around college sports, which is largely a Midwestern and Southeastern phenomena, and how that can drive support for clubs. Now, Atlanta United and Orlando City are two clubs that I think have benefited from the college football culture in their cities, in their areas. And football, European football being the closest thing to college football in a global sense, and then thinking, okay, now we have one of our own type of European football clubs. And that, I think, is part of what drives the television ratings for Atlanta and the interest locally in Atlanta and Orlando. So there are lessons to be learned. The one thing we have learned through the years, though, Chris, is MLS is pragmatic. They change their marketing philosophy regularly, although they have never quite given up on this theory of theirs that they have to be big players in the Los Angeles market and in the New York market. And to this point, maybe LAFC changes it a bit, but to this point, they have not been successful at that.
Yeah, I think the New York side is more about the advertising, kind of all these big brands, all these big companies, and they want to have a huge presence in the New York area. And that could make some big differences, sponsorship or advertising wise. It should make a difference TV market wise, but for whatever reason, people are not tuning in to watch these New York games when they're nationally televised. So 576 for Atlanta, DC United. Yeah. And then Man United against Liverpool had 594,000 viewers. This was on NBCSN and Telemundo on the Saturday at the 7:30. I thought this was a good number, Kartik. It's 4:30 in the morning Pacific time broadcast, and I think that's strong for a Saturday early kickoff.
Yeah, I think though there is a bit of a Mourinho factor with some Man United supporters who at that time in the morning may not have gotten up and watched the entire game because they were expecting some sort of dire football, might have been stunned when they did wake up and see it was 2-0.
Yeah. It was an entertaining game, though. I enjoyed it. Hopefully, Man United supported. I mean, this to me. I mean, going back to what you said in the intro of the show, is that to me, Man United against Liverpool, there is no bigger match in England. That if you're a Man United supporter, all you want to do is beat Liverpool. I mean, that's the goal, and vice versa. If you're a Liverpool fan, all you want to see is your team beat Man United. It's such a hated rivalry between the two clubs and between the two fan bases that it'll often draw big numbers, even if the game isn't that good. This one was a good one, and I think the number was pretty decent.
If one of these years Leeds gets back into the Premier League, we might test that theory. But right now, yeah, it is the biggest. Right. Leeds Man United is at least historically been almost as big for the fans. Maybe not in terms of titles, but that's another huge derby that we never get to see, unfortunately.
Yeah, and Leeds keep on slipping. They always look like they're going to go up, and then they just slip.
Yep.
Let's move on to listener mailbag. We've got one comment here from ZZ Average Geek ZZ, who sent in this tweet. He says, "Turf in Major League Soccer is interesting," and this goes talking about last week's topic. I think where we talked about turf, and he says that I read Portland and Seattle both have the same brand. It comes down to maintenance in its playability, which is interesting. You mean it's. To me, it's an instant turn-off when I turn on, whether it's Atlanta or Seattle or some of the Portland and other places where it is AstroTurf. It is an instant turn-off. But if true, that is interesting in terms of the maintenance of the turf and the playability, which I wouldn't be surprised if that is true. So listeners, if you do have any questions for us, any feedback, anything you disagree with or agree with, and you want to talk to us about, we'd love to read out those comments on air. You can send those to web@worldsoccertalk.com. You can tweet us at World Soccer Talk or message us on Facebook at facebook.com/worldsoccertalk. Now, Kartik, we've got an exclusive interview with Andres Cantor from Telemundo Deportes that I want to share with you, the listeners. And this was just such a delightful discussion with him. And I think if you give this interview a chance, it's about 10 minutes long. It's pretty short, but gives you an idea in terms of how passionate this man is about the sport and how much of a great fit he is for Telemundo and how much he really, really enjoys the game of soccer. And I think that's something that comes through in this interview. It comes through in his commentary and his broadcast for Telemundo, and I'm really looking forward to hearing his goal calls this summer in the World Cup on Telemundo Deportes. So enjoy the interview with Andres Cantor.
What are your memories of your first World Cup you commentated? Which was the first one?
The first one I commentated on TV was 1990, even though the first one I covered was 1986 for a magazine in Argentina called El Gráfico.
Okay.
Which was like the sports Bible in Spanish and all Latin America. The first memory was, just being able to call a World Cup on television was something that I never dreamt, because I wanted to be a sports writer.
Right. Yeah.
I was a sports writer, and I got the chance to work in television, and I was just like pretty much like playing. And like I always say, I as much as the players wait for the World Cup every 4 years, and mm-hmm. I'm very excited that this is happening 100 days away.
So what for you would be a dream final?
Well, the dream final for all Argentinians is Argentina-Brazil. Sure. We almost had it 4 years ago in Maracana. So they could meet each other if they both win their groups. They don't get to play against each other until the final. So that could be a great dream final.
Yeah. So what about your contract with Telemundo? Is it for all three World Cups, or is it?
It's not until 2026, but for the next two, for sure.
Okay.
And then we'll see what happens.
And do you know, as far as kind of who the commentating team is going to be for the World Cup final, who will be joining you in the final?
Manuel Sol is usually my color commentator.
Yeah.
But then, you know, we will have the flexibility of adjusting the tremendous amount of talent that we have.
Right.
Depending on who makes, you know, the knockout phase.
Sure.
So if Uruguay, if I get to go to a game from Uruguay, I'm pretty sure we're going to have Forlan next to me or Abreu. Mm-hmm. If Argentina is in it, I will probably have Juan Pablo Sorín.
Okay.
If Mexico is in it, I will probably have Chicho Ramírez.
Okay.
And so forth.
So lots of flexibility.
Yeah.
Right, right. Have you had a chance to go to Russia to...
Yeah, well,
you
were there, I've been there five times. Right?
So what about the stadium? So in terms of the commentary position, the gantries, I mean, is it top class?
Yes, top class. I've been to... I've been there five times already since the last World Cup. I find that, you know, Russia is a very westernized country. Where, I mean, it has the feel that you're in Europe while you're in Russia.
Right.
All the stadiums that I've been to are really, really nice.
Uh-huh.
The one of them, I think, has the commentary position's a little bit high. I forget which. I think it was Kazan, but the stadium is not that big, so it's not that bad.
Right.
Everything that I've seen so far is excellent. I mean, the stadiums are either brand new or refurbished, so they're very, very good to work. The work environment for us is going to be great, and for the spectators as well, because you can see the game from any, you know, from the last row of the stadium.
Right.
You will be able to see a good match.
The last question I have is, what does it make you feel like when you know that there's English-speaking people out there, soccer fans, who don't speak a word of Spanish, but tune in to watch games because you're the commentator?
First of all, I feel, a great sense of responsibility, because I know that there's people that turn to us, and this happened in 1994 and 98, because they they like the way we call the games with so much passion.
Mm-hmm.
So I have a great deal of responsibility, not only because of that, because what I've been told from the people that stop me in the streets or that, you know, nowadays interact with you on social media, is not only is it the passion that I bring to the game by the way I call it, is the fact that I mention the player's name every time one touches the ball.
Mm-hmm.
Where
right.
in yep. other styles of play-by-play, there are, you know, lots of minutes of silence
right.
while the ball is being tossed around. So if, yep. you know, let's say I'm doing a Guardiola game and they tie, or a Barcelona game where they touch the ball back and forth, you know, 20 uh-huh. times between, I don't know, Iniesta and Busquets, I'll say Iniesta, Busquets.
Yeah,
and
yeah.
I will obviously try to enhance, not to become monotonous, you know,
right.
with stats and this and that,
yeah.
but at least, you know, the viewers will know who carries the ball, who has the...
Right.
The ball at its feet, and so forth. But,
which for the viewer is hypnotic in a good way, because
right.
I mean, Martin Haller does that too, in terms of playing the color names, and it adds more value to the game. I think it really pulls you into the game, so you concentrate who has the ball, where he's moving, or
yeah. So. And then, you know, I live the game with a lot of passion. I mean, every World Cup game for me is like the World Cup finals.
Right.
I have lots of finals ahead, and I'm looking really forward to it.
Excellent. Yeah. Well, Andres, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Good to see you again. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thanks.
Congratulations.
All right, Kartik. So if listeners want to find out where you are on Twitter and latest interviews, articles, analysis, discussion, etc., where can they find you on Twitter?
Find me on Twitter at KKFLA737.
All right. Well, so thank you for listening. You can get a new episode of the World Soccer Talk podcast every Thursday. Every episode is released on SoundCloud, YouTube, Stitcher, iTunes, TuneIn, Audioboom, and worldsoccertalk.com. And if you like the show, share it with your friends on social media and give us a review. And Kartik, what should they do?
Enjoy your football.